We know there's information overload, but is it getting harder to tell what's fact and what isn't?
Information is available almost instantaneously, but it's mixed in with a bunch of misinformation, and science is mixed in with pseudoscience, and there are a whole bunch of websites that are saying stuff that simply isn't true, and the average person's defenseless against this.
It's the latest concept neuroscientist and author Daniel Levitin is tackling in his new book. We get tips from him on how to distinguish between truth and lies on the internet. Plus, award-winning photographer Larry Kamfer talks to us about the beauty he sees in the Midwest.
I call it the magnificence of the everyday. It's the beauty right at your feet. It's really just having to look at it and contemplate it.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's all ahead on a special encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and today we have a special encore edition of the program. You may have heard the saying, there are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics. It's a phrase that was popularized in the U.S. by Mark Twain, among other people, in the 19th century. Well, the digital age has given new rise and meaning to those words. Today, it's not uncommon to go online and find yourself bombarded by statistics, numbers, and news stories shared on social media, quoted by experts and politicians. And what do you do when you encounter conflicting data? Well, now there's a book that promises to help you make sense of all of this. New York Times bestselling author and neuroscientist Daniel Levitin has tackled all of this in his latest work. It's called A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. We're joined now by author Daniel Levitin, who's on the line to give us tips for how to sift the wheat from the chaff in this digital era. Daniel, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be back with you, Nyla.
What prompted you to write this book?
Well, I started writing it in 2001 because I saw that the students that I was having in university were very adept at acquiring information, but not so good at trying to decide whether it was accurate or not and whether it was even truthful or not. So I started teaching a critical thinking course, and my students helped me by collecting examples. And then I think what made me really put the effort into high gear is this strange situation we find ourselves in now, where information is available almost instantaneously, but it's mixed in with a bunch of misinformation, and science is mixed in with pseudoscience, and there are a whole bunch of websites that are, you know, saying stuff that simply isn't true, and the average person's defenseless against this. There's no gatekeeper for the internet.
Well, and you make the point, and a really interesting point in your book that I've never thought very much about. As a journalist, I doubt that.
You think very much about everything.
That's very kind of you. But it's as journalists, I'm taught how to analyze claims. And I do spend a lot of time trying to figure out if people are telling the truth or a lesser shade of that, if what they're saying is accurate. What advice do you have for everyday people who want to get to the bottom of claims they encounter, whether that's in the news or on social media? Because, and we can talk more about this in a minute, it's not just sites that are pretending to be pseudoscience. There's a lot of sites that say that they're journalism, and maybe they're not, or maybe they have a very clear bias.
That's absolutely right. And you can't trust the name of the site anymore. It turns out that martinlutherking.org, a site that you might want to visit, you might think, well, that's got to be neutral. It's not .com, right? It's .org. They're not a commercial enterprise. I want to get information about the great civil rights leader. But once you get there, you learn, to your dismay, that it's a deeply racist site that's promulgating all kinds of falsehoods. And so what it means is that landing on a website can't really be thought of as the end of the research enterprise. That's just when your job begins. And all of us can do what you and I were trained to do as journalists and scientists, respectively, what lawyers are trained to do. We can just start asking some simple questions. Who operates the site? What do we know about them? And might there be biases? And there's a couple of tricks we can use that are really easy.
Like what?
Well, Google has something called the link search. So if you type link colon and then add the URL, that is the site address of a website you're trying to learn more about, it'll tell you all the sites that link to it. Now, that might be useful if you're trying to look up some information on the health benefits of, say, vitamin C, and you end up at a site you don't really know if it's a shill for the vitamin C industry or a neutral site. If it's linked to by sites that are neutral, like the Centers for Disease Control, the Mayo Clinic, you know, reputable sites, and if you go to those sites and they don't say this site is full of lies, then you've learned quite a lot.
There's also a couple principles you talk about in the book, and one of them is that correlation doesn't equal causation. And I think that's something that's drilled into our heads in every statistics class that we've ever taken. But it's something you say that this is a concept that not just lay people, but people like us, scientists or journalists who are supposed to be trained to know the difference, struggle to really grasp this. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, human beings, Nyla, are a pattern detecting species. We look for order in disorder, and that serves us well sometimes, but it also can lead us astray. So to put this in regular terms, just because two things happen together, or the increase in one is followed by the increase in another, it doesn't mean that one caused the other. So in some cases, there is a cause. You smoke a lot of cigarettes, you get cancer. You're very likely to get lung cancer. There are a lot of people who don't, but I mean, it's a very high correlation, statistically likely to get lung cancer if you smoke a lot of cigarettes. And we now understand that smoking causes you to get lung cancer. But a bunch of other things change together and don't have a causal relationship. So, for example, as soon as I finished my cup of tea this morning, the phone rang and it was you. I don't think that my finishing the cup of tea caused you to call.
Right, meant that I caused you to call, sure.
Right. But
I think that when you put it that way, it sounds really simple. But I think when we're reading things, especially when we're reading studies or we're thinking about how, I wonder what principles you think people need to make in order to kind of step back and think, okay, is this really linked?
Yeah, well, so this is where critical thinking comes in, of course. So if you learn that incomes are up in the first year of somebody's presidency, you have to start asking yourself, well, did this president put any policies in place or take any actions that would allow incomes to come up? Or are we seeing the results of some things that were put in place in the last year of the previous president?
That's a good point. You also write about interpreting and framing. And there's the example of Colgate toothpaste, which I think we all know 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate. That's not true?
Well, it is true, but it depends on how you interpret what it means. What I mean by that is, first thing I want to know is what dentists did they ask? Was it a random sample, and were they dentists who were not being paid by Colgate, and were they not in prison for malpractice or fraud or
right.
something? But then the next thing I want to know is what question was asked of them. Now, Nyla, when you hear this claim, 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate, what does it make you think of, you know, with respect to a competitor, say Crest or Aquafresh or Gleam or whatever?
Right, it just makes you think, well, only one of them likes those.
Yeah, if even that, right?
Right.
Well, it turns out the dentists were allowed in this survey to name as many toothpastes as they wanted that they recommended. And it's true, 4 out of 5 recommended Colgate, but they recommended a whole bunch of others, too.
Right. That's it.
In equal amounts.
Sure. And so I think this gets to polling, right? And I think this gets very much to polling data as we think about how important it is to ask, when you think about political polling, the question. Because we often see the results of what a poll is. And sometimes I wonder how much we need to delve into the actual question and the methodology and how important that is.
Well, we do. So a reliable and reputable news organization is going to tell you some details about the poll. They're going to tell you what the margin of error is, which tells you how accurate the number is. If I tell you that a candidate has 40% of the vote with a margin of error of 5%, that means it's somewhere between 35 and 45. If you've got two candidates who are like at, you know, 40, one has 40% of the vote, the other has 43%, and they both, and the polls have a margin of error of 5, in fact, those numbers are indistinguishable. Even though you and I know that 43 is more than 40, it's not statistically more in this particular case. So they need to report to you the margin of error. They need to report whether it was a random sample. did they make sure that everybody they're interested in was equally likely to be asked, in theory? If you stand in front of the horse betting track and just take people leaving there, I don't know if that's a random sample, because people who bet on the horses may not represent the average American voting patterns.
And is your sense that you think nowadays one thing we have gotten better about as our knowledge of science and polling and all of these things in polling people has increased since Gallup first began, what you write about in the book, do you think that we are getting better about narrowing questions and focus and being more accurate about how we're predicting things?
I think actually, as the public, we're getting worse at understanding these things. We've become complacent. We too often don't want to ask the questions or challenge the authorities, because either we're intimidated by the numbers or we're just experiencing information overload and we don't know where to start or how to begin. But I wrote this book because I want the average person, and by that I mean anybody over the age of 12, to be able to listen to the news or read it on Facebook or in a newspaper and just know which questions to ask to help them figure out whether it's true or not. Now, on the polling side, yes, I think pollsters are getting better. They're getting more sophisticated, but we've seen some, as you know, some colossal failures of being able to predict in recent polls, and the polls vacillate wildly. And, you know, the scientists who do this will catch up, the statisticians, but it's tough.
Yeah, it is. I'm speaking with Dan Levitin. He's the author of The Organized Mind, This Is Your Brain on Music, and now most recently, A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. And I can't help think about, I often get emails from relatives who want to know if something they saw on the internet is true. I think this is a pet peeve of all journalists, because we feel the need to, we feel compelled to present accurate information to anyone. I think my mom's sick of me sending, right, she's sick of me sending, she stopped sending them because I just go to Snopes and I send her a message and say, that's wrong, stop spreading misinformation. But
right.
I think that oftentimes when we think about myth busting, do you think that there's so much of an information overload that we are at a point now where we just don't bother to fact check?
I think that's right. And we should. Now, fortunately, there are some fact checking websites. Washington Post runs one. There's PolitiFact. But, you know, they got their hands full. They can't keep up. So we need to do some fact-checking on our own. And it's not that hard. The internet's really good at that.
It's not hard, but I think it is an interesting thing about the way that our brains work, right? And I think this goes back to the correlation and causation. We tend to sort of, in our mind, want things to be easier. I mean, how else? I think there are other ways that we think about this. Like, you write about risk perception. Someone's 1,000 times more likely to die by choking or unintentional poison than death by an airplane crash. But people still get nervous boarding a flight than people do getting into a car. And I always say, look, statistically, you have a much more greater chance of getting hurt on the way to the airport than getting hurt on a plane. But that doesn't seem to reassure people.
We have this misperception of risk based on the vividness of a single story, or, in fact, based on how much media coverage certain things get. This has been known since the 80s, since Paul Slovic first wrote about it, a decision scientist at the University of Oregon. What he noticed was that he tracked the amount of coverage that different causes of death got in newspapers around the country. And then he asked people separately, you know, to rate causes of death for how common they were. And their ratings of causes of death were influenced by media coverage. So as you say, they generally thought there were a lot more drownings and bus crashes and airplane crashes than there were incidents. They thought there were much more than there really are. And they thought there were far fewer things like stomach cancer and the so-called quiet causes of death that you don't read about. And drownings and being hit by lightning, they overestimated by a huge factor. Because when that happens, it's people find it newsworthy. It's such a terrible thing and such a, I think, a frightening thing. But that doesn't mean it's likely.
I want to give an example here, and I think some of this is influenced by news coverage or things of studies. One of our producers has a brother who used to insist he didn't need to wear a seatbelt because when he drives, because he heard that there were incidents where someone died because they were wearing a seatbelt, so therefore it's safer for him not to wear one. How would a critical thinker respond to that?
Well, this is a classic case of a failure to apply critical thinking. So you have to look at the – what you really are doing is playing the percentages here. You're looking at the odds. Yes, there are people who are saved by not wearing a seatbelt. If they had been in their seat and unable to get out of the car, they'd be dead. But that's just a tiny fraction of the number of people who are saved by seatbelts. And you have to look at both sides. You can't just look at one.
You're listening to a special Encore edition of The 21st. It's a conversation that we had with Daniel Levitin back in mid-September. By the way, as we're talking about the internet, you can always find us online. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. That's our handle. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, we're tweeting out news and information about Illinois. So follow us at 21STShow. On our Facebook page, if you search for The 21st to like us, that's where we share what we're working on. You can comment there. You can post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're also available via podcast on iTunes and Android. When we come back, we'll hear more from Daniel Levitin, author of A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. Stay tuned. You're listening to a special Encore edition of The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special Encore edition of the program. We spoke with Dan Levitin in mid-September. It's easy to feel bombarded by all the information we encounter online, whether it's news via social media. And how do you know it's information you can trust? We've been talking with author Daniel Levitin about his new book, A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. Dan, one of the things that oftentimes I think gets confused or conflated in people's head is the basic statistical difference, as well as what's the difference between median versus mean. In fact, there's been news about this recently.
Right. Last week we read that the median income of Americans rose in the last quarter, and that was good news, of course. But what does that mean? What is median? Well, there are different kinds of averages, and often you'll read in the news they just use the word average, and that's an imprecise term. They should tell you that it's the mean or the median. Sometimes they'll say the mode, but it's important to keep them differentiated. I'll give you an example of the median. Suppose you've got five people in a room and you're looking at how much money they have on them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One of them has $1, another has $2, $3, $4, and $5. So the median in this case is the number that lies in the middle. Half the people have more than that amount, half the people have less.
Mm-hmm.
So in that room, the number is 3.
Right.
Half the people have more than $3 on them, half the people have less. The median is sometimes a useful measure, but look what happens. Suppose that the fifth person suddenly has a lot more money.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say the fifth person is Mark Zuckerberg and he's got all of his money on him. So now your distribution of what people have is 1, 2, 3, 4,
and like and 5 billion.
Billion.
Right. Yeah. 60.
Right.
Okay.
So the median doesn't change. The median is still 3, but it's not doing a very good job of characterizing what's in the room, is it?
Right. Sure.
If you were to report the mean, you would add up what these five people have and divide by the number of people. And you'd get, you know, if Mark Zuckerberg's with $50 billion, the other people who have $50 billion, the other people have essentially zero, then the mean is going to be $10 billion per person.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't capture what's in the room either, because there's nobody who has exactly $10 billion, and four of the people don't have anywhere near that.
Right. And I think there's another important part of this, too. When scientists are reporting on data, they often will point out when a certain piece of data has statistical significance. Can you explain what statistical significance really means?
Yes. It's a concept that is can get very bogged down in math and theory. But what it really means is you're talking about the confidence that the statistician has that there's really a difference. So if I tell you that we administered a new headache drug to people and we compared it to ibuprofen and ours did better, maybe 30 people that we studied got better with the new drug and 22 people got better with the old drug. And you're wondering, well, could 8 of the people who were helped by the new one, could that have just been chance or random factors? And if I tell you this is a statistically significant result, what it usually means is that we're 95% confident that the result is real.
Mm-hmm. And I think that oftentimes it's an interesting thing. Would you prefer that journalists or people in the media use the phrase statistically significant more often? Because I don't think we do.
Well, I would. And I think anybody who's read my book, after they read my book, won't be uncomfortable by hearing that. But if they don't tell you statistically significant, you don't really know anything. Like with the polls, with the margin of error, it may be that it's too close to call. If I told you that the new drug helped 30 people and the aspirin helped 29, and I didn't report the actual numbers but just said the new drug did better, and you know, if it costs a whole lot more money, you might not be wanting to pay for it.
Right, and I will say in defense of journalism and journalists such as myself, when I was a business reporter, I did actually look through data and I talked to people and said, is this statistically significant? And oftentimes if they said no, then I wouldn't even write about it or I wouldn't do something on it. So I do think that quite a few journalists in the process of their reporting use that as a tool as to whether or not they're actually going to do something about it. But here's the thing. You also say statistical significance doesn't mean it's practically significant. So what do you mean by that?
Well, so it turns out that if you observe enough people doing things or you observe enough plants in different conditions, if you're testing fertilizer or something, if your number of observations is high enough, you can get statistical significance for something that doesn't really matter. So let's take the aspirin, the new drug ibuprofen example. I could get 30,000 people with headaches, and I haven't worked out the numbers, but you know, to give you a flavor of it, it might be that one person does better out of 30,000 on the new drug than on ibuprofen. And that might be statistically significant, but is it really practically significant if I only have a 1 in 30,000 chance of this being better?
Right. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And I think when people start thinking about this, a lot of this happens when we've been talking a lot about how this comes together in information that's presented in the news or on social media. But a lot of times this happens in everyday issues where health and science and medicine are concerned. And I'm thinking about when people are going to the doctor's office, when they're presented with different prognoses, when they're starting to do research and it kind of comes to hear about probability or in cases that are very dire, survival rates. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that if you're scared, because I think this is a thing that can be tough for people sometimes. And you have a chapter on probability and you get into numbers behind medical screening. And I feel like it's easy for people when they hear that they have a certain screening test that say has a 90% chance of detecting breast cancer. They assume that if the test comes back positive, there's a 90% chance that it's right. But that's not true.
Right. So the first thing I would say about medical decision making is that there's a lot of information and misinformation out there. And one thing that you can do is use a special feature of Google, which is scholar.google.com. And if you use that, you'll return only results that are, or primarily results that are from peer-reviewed journals, and you know, authenticated by doctors and scientists. And so that'll help you see the difference between stuff that is accurate and stuff that's not.
Oh, that's a great tip. Yeah, thanks for that.
Now, we were talking about breast cancer. You're right. It turns out that breast cancer is relatively rare, right? And the test has a small chance of being incorrect. But I work out in the book some examples where you can, without doing any real math, just some simple arithmetic, figure out questions like, well, if I test positive for breast cancer, what's the probability that I really have it? And the good news is that even with a positive mammogram, the probability of actually having breast cancer is under 10%. This is because the disease is relatively rare, less than 1 in 1,000. and the test for it's imperfect.
And so one would assume that that's something that a doctor would say, but what kind of questions do you think we need to ask health professionals or doctors when we're presented with this information to make sure that we're being critical thinkers about it?
Well, the problem here is that many, many doctors don't have training in statistics, and they don't know how to work these things out. And people like Jerome Groopman and Pamela Hartzband and me have been trying to change that. I regularly give talks to groups of doctors, hundreds and hundreds at a time, where I teach them to do this. But they don't always know and weren't always taught the kind of reasoning that you and I just went through with breast cancer. In fact, one surgeon did 93 unnecessary complete breast removals because he misunderstood the statistics.
Wow.
So the question you want to ask your doctor is, what's the probability that I have disease X? And if you get a number that's really high, you should be suspicious and say, well, how rare is the disease? And given the rarity of the disease, what's the probability even if the test showed positive? And the doctor may not be able to answer you, but I give you the tools to work out the numbers yourself. And then you go back to the doctor and you say, look, this is what I worked out. Before we start treatment, let's do a second test.
I'm speaking with neuroscientist and New York Times bestselling author Daniel Levitin. His most recent book is called A Field Guide to Lies. And I think, Dan, as we're thinking about this and you're talking particularly about doctors, I think there is a sense of whether it's a medical professional or someone we're hearing on television, the notion that someone is a quote unquote expert. And I wonder if you talk a lot about this in the book, about people who are experts and what their area of expertise should be and the significance we attach to someone when we think they're an expert and how much we trust that information. How do you think we can do a better job of assessing that?
Well, I think all of us suffer from what might be called the halo effect. We see a person who's really super smart in one domain, and we draw the often erroneous conclusion that they're really smart in another domain. We see somebody who's got a Nobel Prize in physics, and we think, oh, he must be really smart. And so we listen to his views on genetics, perhaps. Which might be really off because he's got no training in genetics. This is what happened with William Shockley, who held deeply racist views based on a poor understanding of genetics, but he had a platform because he'd won the Nobel Prize in physics. And we see this in courtrooms and on TV and unfortunately on the radio. Somebody goes on and they're an expert in one domain, they start pontificating on another and spewing nonsense.
And I think there's some.
So don't ask me any questions about economics.
Don't worry, I won't ask you. We're just sticking to everything that's in this most recent book. I won't even ask you about your other books. How about that? Near the end of this book, you quote U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who talked. I think everyone or people might remember that famous unknown unknowns: the things we know we don't know. You write that these unknown unknowns are the most dangerous. Why do you think that is?
Well, Rummy certainly thought so, and I think he was right. I mean, we don't have to agree with him about everything to agree with a few things. That's another thing with experts and expertise. You don't want to throw out somebody's correct views on something just because you may disagree with them on other things. And so I'm glad you asked me. The unknown unknowns, I think a lot of the great disasters of our time, political and real, Exxon Valdez is an example, are people going headstrong into a situation where they didn't really understand what was ahead, but they thought they did. So they were overconfident. And I think a little humility can solve a lot of the world's problems. We don't know as much as we think we know. And in fact, Rumsfeld is saying there's some things that you're aware of that you don't know and some things that you're not. And it's the ones you're not that will really get you into trouble. So you have to take some extra time, seek some advice and expertise, think ahead to the things that could go wrong to avoid a problem. Back in the old days, before there was fuel injection, I used to drive my car to the mountains. And I drove to Denver once, which is a mile in elevation. And I knew that I had to change the inflation in my tires. And I had somebody told me that I needed to use higher test gas because of the thinner atmosphere, higher octane. But what I didn't know was that I needed to have my carburetor adjusted because the thinner air meant I wasn't going to have enough air to keep the engine going. And because of that unknown, I broke down at the side of the road, and this is in the age before cell phones, and I was stuck there.
Right. Well, and I think that's helpful to think about how we can think about the limitations of our own knowledge. But I think there's two final things I wanted to sort of end by talking to you about. And you write about this I think all of the book kind of comes to two major points about how you think there's a bit of not just an anti-science bias, but also, and conversely, an anti-skeptical bias against what people read online. Let's start with the anti-science bias. What's that about?
You know, I think part of it is that a lot of us feel intimidated by science, intimidated by numbers, and so that fuels part of it. We see numbers and we think they're incontrovertible, but they're not. They're just gathered by people and reported by people, so there are biases there. And then people don't understand how science works, and they observe in the public display of science that scientists seem to change their minds a lot. First, you're supposed to eat red meat, and then you're not, and then you're supposed to have a lot of carbs and get on the pasta Mediterranean diet, and then carbs are bad. These scientists just can't make up their minds. They don't know anything. But, you know, speaking from the inside as a scientist, what we're doing is staying open to the possibility that we were wrong and correcting ourselves as new information comes along, which is how science and medicine works. And it's supposed to be how the political system works. We're supposed to have intelligent debate where ideas are exchanged. And even though we thought we favored one candidate throughout the process of an election cycle, optimally, we're keeping an open mind to hear what the other side has to say, and maybe we'll switch over. But there seems to be less and less of that open-mindedness. It's not just an anti-science bias, Nyla. It's an anti-change-your-mind or anti-new-information bias.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I mean, and when we have that, when we just think people are so set in whether they're presented with facts or conversation or information, and we've seen this. Maybe I shouldn't say there is research that shows this, but how do you think we can overcome that, being so rigid or not being open to changing? Because you're saying scientists do that. I mean, it sounds like you'd also like to say you wish everyone would do that, be open to assessing and being critical about information and then changing your mind if you think that's wrong.
Right. Well, I think people lack the skills and books like Charles Whelan's Naked Statistics and my book and How to Lie with Statistics, which was written in the 50s. There are a lot of books that aim to make critical thinking fun and easy and something that's part of your routine in just a couple of hours of invested time to sort it out. So I think it's about empowering the average person to realize that they can do this, and they can do this for themselves, and they don't have to be dependent on others who might have an ideological bias that's different than theirs.
And they can do it by reading A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age by author Daniel Levitin. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Great to be back with you.
You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Whether it's a row of corn, Riley titled fall lineup, working farms, or breathtaking images of falling water, photographer Larry Canfor's love of Midwestern landscape shines through in the images of his latest book, A Prairie State of Mind. It's the eighth book of photographs a Central Illinois-based photographer has published. We spoke with him just as the book came out earlier this fall. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
You wrote in the introduction to this, the preface to all of your photographs, that when you first started out, you felt like you maybe had to compensate for the pictures that you were taking of the Midwest and of landscapes. It seemed too simple. Is that an accurate description of where you were at originally?
Yeah, I had moved from Portland, Oregon, and where everything was real obvious and
dramatic.
It was sort of I think I look back and I think I really wanted to romanticize it here because I didn't really see all the layers of the beauty at that point. So I did use soft focus and grain and, you know, high grain photographs. And if there was some garbage in the scene, I would take that out. I just wanted to make it look just perfect. And then as I went along, I started to really appreciate it is what it is. And, you know, and it's beautiful just the way it is. So I started, you can see that this has kind of evolved into a lot more sharp, colorful images of the Midwest.
Well, and as you think about that, as you think about these images that are of you traveling all across the Midwest, I wonder how you felt like that philosophy has changed now in this most recent work of yours. Do you really just think when you're coming across scenes or when you're out shooting, do you just sort of feel like I just need to be in the moment and capture that as opposed to I need to stage it or make sure?
Yeah, I've not staged things, but I've actually gone from being in the moment to what I consider now to look a little more in depth. So I know a lot more about the Midwest, you know, the ebbs and flows of the people and the natural cycles. And I think that plays a lot more than it used to. So instead of looking for just a composition, a focus point here and, you know, a foreground there, I kind of think about it in terms of, you know, the history or, you know, the fields have drain tiles here because this was swamp area. So so it's something to think about, you know, when you have when you see an element like a drain tile in the field. And another example would be the hay bales. You know, they've changed from rectangle to round. You know, why is that? It's a mechanization. And so I kind of look at things a little bit different and a little more in depth now than just superficially as a image.
Well, and there's one image in the book, and it goes across two pages, and you are in the middle. It's the shot of, it's like you're in the middle of a sea of sunflowers, and they just go on and on for, I mean, I just, as far as the eye can see these sunflowers, so they have the up focus of the ones that are close to you in the background. Can you tell us where this was shot, and do you remember this moment?
Yes. In fact, I may not always remember precisely where, but I always remember the images when I'm doing it. That is about 15 photographs put together.
Wow. Okay.
I'll do a basically to get the range of image, to get the range of tone, the dynamic range. I'll take three or four, and then to make it a larger file size, I'll stitch together maybe on that image maybe five different pieces of it, so that as you enlarge it, it's very sharp. What I loved is that there was this foreground, the background. It did look like a sea. We don't have, you know, people love to go to the ocean or the mountains and look out. We have seas here, but they're a little more finite. You could see the end. We have sea of corn, sea of, you know, it's the same feeling of being on an edge, though.
And are you driving around? Are you looking for this? Or do you just sort of, are you spending, how do you come across something like this to make a photograph like this?
A lot of times I will go, I'll go to an area that I want to pursue and do a little bit of background study, you know, on what that area is about. I love being an outsider looking in because I don't take things for granted, and I love to look at the history of a place or how the people deal with it. And then I'll go to that place when I think that the sky is going to be right. And then I go look for a composition in that place. So, you know, a little bit of background, go to a place, and then look for a composition that kind of exemplifies that particular location.
So there's more than 100 photographs in this book, they're from all across the Midwest. How did you choose locations to shoot? Did you specifically choose locations for this book, or are these things that you've taken over time?
There are pieces that I've taken over time. So,
and as you've done that, how far have you gone? Have you sort of and I'm not going to ask you where your favorite state is to photograph, because I know I'm going to sense that you're not going to have an answer for that. But I wonder if you can mention a couple places you've been that sort of kind of stand out to you in terms of different states across the Midwest.
Okay. I actually love near the Quad Cities, on either side, but on the other side, the Iowa side, you've got when the sun is very low, you've got these beautiful hills there. I mean, in central Illinois, we might call them mountains, but they're just these beautiful hills, and the sun makes this nice composition with lines, and I think that's really nice. I'm attracted to Starved Rock.
And it's interesting because as we're thinking about different states, there are different landscapes across the Midwest, right? Because we might tend to think, oh, everything's flat, but I guess you probably found that's not necessarily the case.
No, but I really do love the more flat. It for a couple of reasons. One, it's a challenge to try and get that subtlety. So I have to say Missouri's a little too hilly, and even Wisconsin's wonderful. But it's got. I like a little bit more of the flat. That's not to say that I don't enjoy going to the mountains and photographing.
Well, and in fact, we wanted to have you on last week, but you were out in California. We were told you were in the field.
Yes.
What were you doing out in California?
That was spectacular. It was in Napa Valley, the wine harvest, the grape harvest.
Okay.
And that's a whole nother thing. It was really, really great. So I was really to show how it was being harvested, and everything was perfect. Of course, the weather was, just right every day. And
well, and as you think about this, as you've traveled across the country, taking photographs of different regions, for you, do you think that for the Midwest, do you really feel like it is, as you've said, the prairie state of mind? For you, what do you think are the different defining characteristics from what you've seen of the landscape of the Midwest?
Well, I think one of the things that strikes me most, I believe, is that now I've been here for, 20, 30 or more years, and there's a solidness of repetition. Repetition of the corn, the cycles, you get this time of year is fall, it's beautiful. All of a sudden, the corn turns this beautiful golden brown. The landscape is really nice. Everything sort of stops and it's peaceful. And then suddenly you see the landscape you see the horizon line because the corn because everything is harvested. And then there's this white embossed landscape. So,
I wonder also if you see a lot of geometry. There's certainly a lot of the images in here where there are just so many interesting patterns and shapes to what you have seen in landscapes of fields, whether that's lines of crops or fields themselves, as they're sort of very neatly delineated. Do you think that's something you see most often here in the Midwest?
I do. It could be, you could have it elsewhere with the hills and the vineyards, have these lines. But I love to see the black soil, the really deep black soil with the little furrows and peaks and valleys and really highlight that.
In your most previous book, in 2014, you released a book. It was called Chicagoscapes. Mm-hmm. That was a joint project with your wife, right? And she's from Chicago?
Originally, yes.
Originally. I wonder, how do you approach shooting something like when you're in the city, you're trying to do Mag Mile, anywhere on Michigan Avenue or a neighborhood street like Devon, versus is it different when you're photographing out in a field and most of the images here, which really, actually, there's no people in any of these, I'm thinking about it.
There's a little different adrenaline flow there. I'm working probably a little quicker, but in order to...
In a city.
Right. In 2003, when I went digital, it enabled me to really go into the city to photograph what I've always kind of enjoyed seeing, textural street corners and people interacting. And I really love that. So I it's a little different. It's just a lot more energetic that way.
And one of the things that was really amusing me was the titles of your photos. I mentioned Fall Lineup, which is the stacks of corn. Mm-hmm. There's this picture of falling water where you capture the water, and it's called Stream of Consciousness. Mm-hmm. How do you come up with those? Do they just come to you in the moment?
No, it takes a little bit of time. What I do is I look at the photograph, and I try and remember what I was thinking at the time. And it's kind of this long process, and I work with my staff, too, and come up with some of them. It's really a...
You know, you mentioned that going digital, that was maybe, a little longer than 10 years ago. And when we're thinking about this picture we were talking about with the sunflowers, how many you stitched together, how do you think the techniques of photo technology have changed what you do?
It really... became a lot more exciting, I think, with digital. Once digital got to be of the same quality, if not better, there are so many more possibilities. You're truly limited by your imagination. However, I don't, unless I specifically say an image is interpreted, I don't change things. I'm able to take them differently, like with a gigapan where I could do 150 photographs in one shot and stitch those together, or high dynamic range where I get the lights and the darks and everything. But I don't put in a fake blue sky, or, you know, I've realized that a lot of what I feel like I do best is to show really what it's like, and people can feel that this is my front porch.
Right? Well, and there's this remarkable one in here, and you entitled it Rose-Colored Glasses, mm-hmm. and it's this stunning purple or pink-hued mm-hmm. Shot of clouds coming across a field with water. And I was, and you didn't shoot this with a filter. There's no filter.
No,
this is actually what the sky looked like. And I mean, that's the thing that I love the most about the landscape here, is how you can see storms coming mm-hmm. across. I mean, when you're shooting weather or storms, is that a more exciting or more difficult
it
thing?
It is more exciting. I love the skies we have here. That's everyone really, I think, sees that, but it doesn't necessarily register on a moment to moment. You know, from moment to moment. I have the advantage of taking a moment in time and highlighting that in two dimensions. So, you know, that particular image, the sun just before it sets, you know, it'll light up the bottom of a cloud bank.
Larry, do you have an audience in mind when you take a picture? And I'm thinking, especially maybe not when you take a picture, but as you're putting together everything for A Prairie State of Mind, is this for people from the Midwest, or for people who you want to see, to maybe want to introduce them to parts of the Midwest they haven't necessarily seen?
I think it's for the people from the Midwest. However, you know, if you want to brag about how beautiful it is here, this might be something where you can show that it really is beautiful. You get people from, you know, not to pick on California or Oregon, but
Napa. Go ahead, pick on Napa.
There
that's
you go.
Fine.
that come in and or even that come from the city up north, and they're driving down. And they say, "There's nothing here." Well, there's so much here. It's magnificent. I call it the magnificence of the everyday. It's the beauty right at your feet. It's really just having to look at it and contemplate it.
Larry Kimfer is talking about his latest book. It's a compilation of his photographs. It's called A Prairie State of Mind. Larry, thank you so much for being with us.
Certainly my pleasure.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links and every other way to contact us, whether that's via phone, email, or social media, is all at our website, www.21stshow.org. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Steve Mork and Jason Croft. Scott Cameron is our news director. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.